Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. In 2011, posters started appearing at Army, National Guard, and Reserve facilities looking for female soldiers eager to become a part of history, that's what the sign said, by training to perform cultural support roles in Afghanistan. You could be forgiven if you assumed that job title implied the military was planning some kind of goodwill public relations effort. In fact, though, the program was a first-of-its-kind attachment of women to units where they had never served roles before. They were directly and deliberately working in combat areas alongside special forces units conducting nighttime village raids. The women had to be ready and able to travel and fight just like their male colleagues, but they were officially there to do something the men never could: communicate directly with Afghan women to gain vital intelligence. Gail Samaklaman is senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She writes about this groundbreaking effort enacted 2 years before the ban on women in combat was suspended in her new book, Ashley's War: The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield. She's in town to appear at the Bush Center, where she and I will have a conversation on stage this evening, followed by a book signing. Gail, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So in 2009, the commander of U.S. Special Operations, Eric Olson, realized he had a problem in Afghanistan.
Yes, this whole story really begins with some of the most tested special operations leaders asking themselves, you know, how do we win this war without women? Right, that there was a real security gap out there because male soldiers, no matter how good they were at combat, could not talk to Afghan women. So everything women knew and saw and understood was out of reach. And so, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're in Dallas or in Afghanistan, right? If you want to know what's happening in a home or in a community, often the people you talk to are women. And so much information was being left behind on the battlefield that Admiral Olson and other special operations commanders said, you know, it would be a great help to the war effort to have women out there.
Now, it would seem that when you conduct a raid on a village, you're at least temporarily in control of everything that goes on there. Help us understand why it was really impossible for male soldiers to extract this kind of information.
Well, and I think it's really important. These were the kinds of nighttime operations where you were trying to keep the pressure very specifically, very targeted on insurgents. And so you were looking for very specific information and very specific people. And women in the house often knew, for example, let's say there were two or three men in the house, there could be as many as 5 or 10 women and plus a number of children. And so everything that the women knew was going unknown, because in a conservative and traditional country like Afghanistan, to have male soldiers talking to Afghan women would have been a huge cultural affront. So you needed women out there, American women or female soldiers, to talk to other women and understand everything that they knew. And that could be, as example, in one of the nights in the pages of Ashley's War, where it was a woman soldier talking to an Afghan woman who figures out that there's a barricaded shooter who's lying in wait to ambush Afghan and American forces.
And the women did know a lot. I think a lot of people might assume that women in a country where they don't have complete rights the way we do in this country, that maybe the women are just sort of off in their own sphere. In fact, they're paying close attention and they can be very useful.
Look, women see and know everything that's going on in their homes. It does not matter where you are in the world. And I think that is what special operations commanders had also very much come to understand. And as they would say, General McChrystal, others who were interviewed for this book would say, you know, we were late to understanding all the nuances, but we understood early on that women held a whole lot of information that we couldn't access. And so it took a while, but this was really the first time you've seen women recruited, trained, and deployed as a team, which we've really never as a country gotten to see, because so often women are ones and twos or threes in much larger, mostly men teams.
What's really astonishing is that women had been used on an ad hoc basis to perform similar functions in the past, but literally were pulled from completely different jobs without the appropriate training.
Yes. And in fact, one of the women in this story, but it's also important to remember this was war, right? So a lot of people end up in roles that they weren't trained for. But yes, I mean, that story struck me. One of the women in this story, Grace, you know, she was at a medic, and somebody came in, one of her commanders came in and said, hey, do you want to go get bad guys? right? That was the full extent of her training. And soon enough, she found herself out on nighttime operations alongside some of the most tested, best trained, most experienced special operations soldiers. And I think it just speaks to the need, you know, because very quickly after that, you really do start to see the formalization of these programs where they, you know, had these recruiting posters that you mentioned become part of history. You see more than 110 women come to Fort Bragg in 2011 for what was called 100 Hours of Hell. And you see this real formalization of trying to find the best, the fittest, the most fierce, and also most feminine, right? Women who could show that they were women in the heat of a nighttime operation to come out on these very important and also very high-risk missions.
All right, I want to talk about First Lieutenant Ashley White, who is the title character of your book. She absolutely embodied all of those qualities. Growing up, she was the last person probably anyone would have assumed would become this fierce warrior.
Yes, she is, I think, still, you know, this mix of Martha Stewart and what we think of as G.I. Jane. You know, she was somebody who loved to cook dinner for her husband and also loved to put 45 or 50 pounds of weight on her back and road march for 8 or 9 miles. And she was somebody who was always looking at other people. What can she do to help others and to make people better? And she would never be someone who would tell you how good she was, right? She was the one who, if you needed an extra pair of boots or you wanted a home-cooked meal, she was the one that you called. And as a child, she was just incredibly quiet, wrestled with confidence issues the way so many teenage girls do. And it's really through the military and through ROTC that she comes into her own.
She had a twin sister.
Yes, who is actually here in Dallas and will be at the Bush Center event this evening, who is and just this incredible young woman, athletic and intense and very smart and just a real self-starter. And I think they were one another's support and best friends as children and really did not compete with one another, but always pushed one another to be better.
When this recruitment was happening, Ashley was a newlywed, and understandably, her husband was like, what are you thinking? Why would you want to do something like this when we got married just a couple of months ago?
Yes. I mean, Ashley is the heart of this team of all-stars, right? There were women from Alabama to Alaska who just answered this call to serve, who had always wanted to be with the best of the best, to be on a mission that mattered, and to be serving in a way that tested their own personal limits, right? And you had women who were all kinds of backgrounds, but Ashley, I think, was the heart of them because of her mix of kindness and ferocity. You know, that, and her husband was this beautiful source of support, right? They were Kent State ROTC sweethearts. And this story, Ashley's War, is as much a love story as it is a war story. And so when she initially comes and says there's this program to put women on special ops alongside Rangers, he's like, whoa, 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 you know, do you understand what you're getting into? Because this is real combat. He had been deployed in 2009. He knew very well what Afghanistan meant and was worried that she would be getting herself into something that was a lot more dangerous than she had expected.
And so she said to him, and I don't know how completely honest she was. She said, I probably won't even make it through the training. Let me just try and see what happens.
Yes. And she is one of those people who he instantly knew she would make it if she tried. You know, and he was never worried that she wouldn't make this team because he knew, look, she was one of those people who could, you know, not say anything but walk up to a pull-up bar and do 30 pull-ups from a dead hang. You know, and then kind of shuffle away as if she had done nothing. That was who she was. She would push herself to the outer limit and always had as a child. And because she was in this incredibly athletic and competitive family, she had pushed herself from being a very small child in a very physical way. So he knew she was going to make it. And I think his only concern was, you know, what would happen once she did. But yes, I do think she was genuine in that she probably wasn't certain, given the caliber of people who would come compete for a spot, that she would win a spot. But of course, she was right there up front when they called the names who had made it.
I'll tell you what I loved, Gail, reading the book was as the call went out for people, if they were interested, the number of women certainly who were interested, but lots of women within the military said, like, this isn't going to work for me. But they would call up a buddy, a female buddy, and say, you really should go for this, or this is right up your alley. It sounds like there's this subculture of support among women in the armed services.
Ashley's War, I think, at its heart, is a story of friendship. this is a story of female friendship in the least likely of places, right, on the special operations battlefield. And there were so many women in this story who had friends who would say, I would never do this, but this is perfect for you. And, you know, if you talk to a lot of military leaders, they'll say the special operations best are physically fit problem solvers. And I think all the women who, when they saw that become part of history poster and raise their hands, would meet that criteria, right? And so it was this self-selecting band of real performers who wanted to be doing something that mattered and who were just driven not to show how great they were, but to do a mission that mattered to America.
Did Eric Olson and the people who helped him conceive of this program have any trouble selling it to their colleagues?
There's a moment in Ashley's War where, you know, there's a conversation about a lot of people initially waiting for the next special operations commander to come in once they hear this idea, you know. But a few months later, Admiral McRaven, who's at that point was the head of Joint Special Operations Command, puts in a formal request to have women out there alongside Rangers. So as Admiral Olson would say, you know, it went from being his idea of the yin and yang of warfare to a very hard request from a commander in the field who wanted women to be out there alongside his forces who were going really trying to keep the pressure on the insurgency and were in night raids night in, night out, 4 months.
To step back for a minute here, how was the ban on women in combat justified in the first place?
So it was this ban on women in ground combat came from a 1994 memo that was actually opening up other roles to women. You know, in the late 1940s, when some of the first laws about women in combat come, it wasn't even conceived of to ban women from ground combat. In part, as some of the historians told me, because the idea itself was so outrageous.
They were there to be nurses and secretaries and that
That's
sort of
right. And look, some of those nurses saw a very real, you know, war around them. But this was really never even thought of at that time, that there would be women in ground combat. And so as it gets closer, as the 80s pass and the 1990s pass, you start to have ways where they'll say, well, we'll open these roles up to women, but these not. And so that was where the ground combat came from, a 1994 memo.
There, of course, was the question of whether men who had been accustomed to doing this all on their own would accept women. How did that process work as women started to be attached to these really elite units?
You know, I mean, in the pages of Ashley's War, what I wanted to do was to pull back a curtain, because there are so many myths around, well, men will never accept women and all. You know, there's so much that we don't know about this world. And I really wanted Ashley's War to be one way into that world. And what I found over 2 years of interviews was that this was a decade into the war. All anybody wanted was solutions. You talk about Rangers. These guys had been continuously deployed since 9/11. They wanted people who could help with the mission. If you were out there and you were finding information, finding people, getting valuable intel, you know, doing things that directly contributed to the mission's accomplishment, you were part of the team. And it's not that everybody was singing Kumbaya and everything was perfect, but by and large, you're talking about people who really wanted to see the mission accomplished, and they didn't care who was doing it. And, you know, one Ranger first sergeant who's retired now, he did 13 deployments, right? That's almost more than 4 years of combat. And he said to me, a job well done sticks out. I don't care who's doing it. And I think that was the case. Once you saw, you know, in these pages, you see so many nights that it was women who found information that mattered, you know, whether it's finding an AK-47 or one night when one of Ashley's teammates finds that there are explosives all around where they're just standing, right? And she gets that information. That's information that matters to the mission, and they didn't care that it was women who were getting it.
We're speaking this hour with Gail Samaklamon, who is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new book, Ashley's War, The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield. She's in town to appear this evening at the Bush Center. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd. Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies Program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking with author Gail Samaklamon, who's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of a new book called Ashley's War, The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield. She's in town to appear tonight at the Bush Center. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Gail, it's worth noting here that despite the ban on combat that existed until 2013, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan really changed the roles of women. And no matter what you were assigned to do, there was a very good chance that you would find yourself in the line of fire in these conflicts.
Absolutely. You know, there were no front lines in these wars, Afghanistan, Iraq. These were not regular armies confronting regular armies, right? And the United States military had to get very innovative about who was going to be out there and what skills were going to be needed. And I think the what Ashley's War shows is that evolution. You know, in 2003, women were pulled from mechanic jobs, all kinds of other jobs, to be part of the Lioness program in Iraq, which was searching women. I mean, this was all stuff that was created to solve problems that the United States military was seeing in the field.
So women, American women in Afghanistan dressed as soldiers, don't look or act very much like Afghan women. And in fact, they're viewed as almost like a third gender.
And, you know, that's true for reporters as well, right? I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan for the first book I did called The Dressmaker of Karkana. And what you see, and a lot of the women in Ashley's War, we would talk about this a lot, that there is this third gender. You are not local female. You're not an Afghan female, so you don't have the restrictions on mobility that face so many Afghan women. But you're also not American male, which is seen, you know, as aggressive and sort of much more on the military side. And, you know, when you're a female in military uniform, you're taken seriously because of the uniform you wear, because you're a soldier, but you are not seen as the same kind of weapon-carrying aggressor, rightly or wrongly, right, as American men are. And in fact, the Rangers were the first ones to say that. Like, you know, I'd had guys would say to me, you know, I look scary when I come in the middle of an operation, but if a female soldier takes off her helmet and says, you know, I'm a female soldier, I'm here to protect you, I'm here to keep you away and here to talk with you, they can help to de-escalate that situation. Now, this is still war. But it definitely is a very different dynamic than having only men on the battlefield. And I think the Rangers were the first ones to really speak very eloquently about that with me over the years of working on this story.
I love the story that a couple of women told you that they would put their hair up in braids. And then when they felt that it was safe, they would take their helmets off and undo the braids. So it was sort of this connection that women have with one another.
That's right. Wherever you are in the world. Right. Yeah. And that story is that from Amber, who's one of the people in Ashley's War. She is another amazing character, you know, like used to like to shoot targets as a kid in Pennsylvania, wanted to join the infantry, found out women couldn't. Becomes an intel officer, serves in Bosnia, and really trains to be physically ready the moment she sees this recruiting poster go up. You know, she wants to be out there alongside these guys. And she would wear these things called, she would call combat braids, which was because U.S. commanders had said, we want you to be able to show women that you're women. And the Rangers would joke with them in these pages, you know, oh my God, I'd never take off my helmet. But that was part of their job, was to keep women away from the operation as much as they could and to take off their helmet and say, I'm a woman, and explain to that. And the braids for Amber were really a way to show that, that she was female very quickly.
All right, let's talk about the training, because this really is astonishing. And it gives me such great respect, as if I didn't already have respect for what these women had to do. The 100 Hours of Hell was sort of the culmination of all this, but it was really this speed program that only half of these very well-qualified women managed to make it through. What was the balance between physical conditioning and, like, intellectual training for the kinds of relationships they would need to build and the work that they would need to do?
Yes, this was a real mix. 100 Hours of Hell is part of Ashley's War. You know, you talk to the people who designed it. This was really set up. They were called building a plane in mid-flight, right? You had women who were recruited in March. They were selected in either March or May. and trained in June and July. And by August, they were seeing the kind of combat that less than 5% of the entire United States military sees. So this was a really quickly assembled program to put the best women out there. And 100 Hours of Hell was 5 days of a selection process. And, you know, there's a whole chapter of Ashley's War that sort of takes you into this team building that goes on as these women together face these really challenging physical tests. Climbing a 30-foot wall, putting 45 pounds of weight on your back and marching for a, quote, unknown distance, unquote, right, which ended up being more than 10 miles. And not everybody can take that, right? Not even the fittest can take that physically. Figuring out a way to go underneath a wooden barricade, you know, how do you shimmy underneath a wooden barricade and get your people to the other side? And then there were problem-solving tests. You know, what is your mental agility? How do you fare under pressure? Simulations of being in an Afghan home, where things go very wrong very quickly. And you see in this, in Ashley's War, I think a whole team being built because some people were very good at one and some people were very good at the other, and they were really working with one another to be better at all of them.
And they had to really, I mean, understand that it could turn violent at any moment. I think somebody in the book says, like, you know, these women are there to build relationships and get intelligence, but they also have to be prepared to turn around and shoot somebody in the face if it turns out that what they thought was happening is not what's happening.
That's right. That's from their ranger trainer, right, who is somebody who served 12 deployments, right, and who at first he's at Fort Benning and they say, hey, you got to go train girls. And he's, oh, my God, you know, he has no idea what to expect. But there's a whole chapter in this dedicated, you know, to his week with them, because he sees them and immediately sees that they're serious. They have heart. They have courage. They have grit, this group of women who's answered this call to serve. And he wants to train them in exactly the way he would train any ranger private, because they're going into combat for the first time. Now, for some of these women, this was their own third or fourth deployment, but a lot of them hadn't, and they certainly hadn't been on special operations missions. So he's really focused on this combat mindset piece, and that was what opens his chapter, is him saying, at the drop of a hat, the person you think is a woman could be a man, and you better be ready to react in that moment, and really trying to get them mentally prepared for that.
And women could also be dangerous.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, in one of the parts of Ashley's War, it's actually Ashley's interpreter, Nadia, who's an incredible person, an Afghan-American who left Orange County, his comforts, to go serve America, and was very vital role of being the eyes and ears and voice of these women. And Nadia says to him, says to Ashley, look, some of these women will lie straight to your face and they could win an Oscar. They lie so well, right? Because they know their husbands are Taliban and they're perfectly happy to protect them. That's what they see their role as. And so, you know, I think it's the fact that it is war, but they also were really trying to retain their humanity and to keep this, to know the limits of their roles, and also to push the boundaries of what they could do, because they wanted to make the biggest, these women wanted to make the biggest contribution they could. They were there not to prove a point, but to serve with purpose.
So they had this really rigorous training. They knew what they were there to do, but they were in some ways making this up as they went along on the job. And one of the things that really impressed me was the way that they were assigned to different units and they would stay in contact and basically brief each other. Okay, here's what I learned today. Definitely don't do that. Tell us how that worked.
Yes, I think that just points to this whole new band of sisters, which we've never really gotten to see as a country, because we've never seen, you know, this whole idea of women being recruited, trained, and deployed as an all-women team for a very specific special operations mission. And so they were really, you know, it was hard sometimes to be only one or two women on a base filled with men. And what they would do would be, and also there weren't other women in their roles, their very specific roles. So Lita, who's their officer in charge, she's an incredible person who had been a high school track coach in her previous life. She sets up these video conferences and a weekly email through their secure network, and they would say, what did we learn? What did we do well? What happened that was, you know, one woman told a story about, you know, just biting it and falling straight over in the middle of the night, because they were, it was the middle of the night when they'd go on these operations, and night vision goggles often would not give you the same depth perception that regular world would offer you. And so they would have funny stories about embarrassing things, things that really worked well, things that they needed to learn from, and they would really stay together as friends. And then really they became family over the course of this deployment.
as they went on and had these experiences, they were also in contact back home. And what were those? How did they describe to you that? What's it like to be essentially just off the battlefield and then, you know, emailing home to mom and dad or a boyfriend or a sister?
Surreal. Yeah. Disconnected. I mean, I think those are the adjectives that most of them would use. A lot of these women in Ashley's war had either boyfriends or husbands who were in the military, which made it easier and harder both. Easier in the sense that they understood, but harder in the sense that they understood the risks too, and so would worry even more. But I think it doesn't matter whether you're male or female or man or woman, right? It's very hard to be on a battlefield in life and death situations and then come off and be able to connect with people who are, you know, watching Real Housewives or people who are, you know, going on with their day as if nothing were happening, as if America were not at war. And so I do think that so much of what I wanted Ashley's War to capture was to really show who these people are and to show the stakes, that they're not one-dimensional superheroes. They're people with families who simply push themselves to extraordinary limits.
Another thing that comes up in this book is the persistent problem of sexual assault within the military. It happens to men, too, but it particularly happens to women. And I wonder if you came away with the sense that because this still exists, despite the fact that now everyone knows that it happens and most people acknowledge that it happens, does this still send a message to women that they are not as valued as their male counterparts, that we can't get a handle on this?
It's an excellent question. So Chairman Dempsey, Joint Chiefs, would actually argue, has argued, that because there are two classes, you know, the women who are barred from combat and men who are allowed in combat, even though all of those roles are shifting, it has made this crime more, it's certainly not more acceptable, but it has made it more frequent. And I would argue that what these women in Ashley's War were showing with their experiences was that that experience was not going to define them. Right. You know, there's Lane, who was an Iraq war veteran, who was sexually assaulted by a soldier in another unit while she was in Iraq. And she wants to do this mission specifically because the special operations mission. She wants to put herself in the toughest environment possible and prove to herself she will never be a victim again. And I wanted to just mention that and move on, because one thing I found over the 2 years of writing this story was that if you would say, I'm writing a story about special operations, people would say, that's great. What has to do with women? Oh, is it about rape or PTSD?
Hmm.
And that was shocking to me, because it just shows you that the valor story of what women have actually done on the battlefield these past decade of war is so missing from our conversation. And it's part of why I wanted Ashley's War to show both the awful and the tragic, but also the real courage and the grit and the heroism and the valor that women have been showing on the battlefield this past decade of war.
There's always a risk when you are telling a story of how women can do something as well as men, or conversely, men can do something as well as women, of sort of overplaying the differences between them, saying this wouldn't be as good if they weren't so different. Yeah. However, there are sort of different ways that women and men approach certain situations. A woman might be more inclined, for example, to imagine that a mother might hide something important on her baby.
Yes, there's a story in Ashley's War. There's Kimberly, one of the members of this team. She's incredibly fit, drill sergeant, you know, and then she gets to Fort Bragg for this 100 hours of hell, and she's just blown away by how great all these women are. She's never been around women who are this good. And that was the experience for so many of them. They had never been around women like themselves. So she makes the team. She goes, she's working with a team of SEALs, and they have no idea why she's there. Been doing just fine all these years without you. And they're on a mission one night, and it's actually Kimberly who figures out, finds out that what they're looking for is actually wrapped up in a wet diaper, right? And, you know, proves herself in one night to a team of SEALs who had really, you know, they just didn't understand why she was there, right? And then all of a sudden, sort of the light bulb goes off for them, and they would all kind of joke about it for the rest of that deployment.
What did Ashley White's mom and dad think she was doing in Afghanistan?
They understood that she was helping women and children, but back on a base and kind of doing medical-related aid.
So they weren't—I'm sure they worried about her, but I don't think we're telling any. It's a bit of a spoiler, but I think it's important to tell the story. Ashley White was killed in the line of duty.
She, this incredible young woman, this woman who really had, was what everybody said, the best of us. You know, she was the best of us in terms of values, in terms of always taking the hard right over the easy wrong. And, you know, somebody who would walk up to a 15-foot rope, climb it using only her arms, and then kind of apologize because the Rangers had trained them to use both their arms and their legs. You know, I mean, that's who she was. And so when she is killed on a night that begins like any other, right, on October 22nd, 2011, alongside two Rangers, Christopher Horns and Christo May, she really throws this program, which was built for the shadows, into the very public spotlight. And it is shocking for her parents when they learn what it was that she was doing. You know, they first learned about what she was doing with the special operations community at Dover Air Force Base.
Even the scene when military doctors are trying to save her life is surprising. Somebody shouts out, "It's a female." They didn't expect that.
Yes, because it's one thing to know women are on the front lines. It's another thing to understand that they were on those kinds of night raids that were really incredibly essential at that point to the war effort, but also very dangerous. And, you know, at that point in the war, America had gotten fairly good at minimizing casualties. So to have a night that was as bad as that one was noteworthy for a number of reasons, but also because there were women out there.
And the situation was that someone accidentally triggered a series of mines that were sort of linked together.
That's right. There was a daisy chained improvised explosive device that someone stepped on in another part, and a soldier stepped on in another part of the compound, and that triggered a number of other explosions.
We're speaking this hour with Gail Samak-Lamon. She's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she has a new book out called Ashley's War, the untold story of a team of women soldiers on the special ops battlefield. She's in town to appear this evening at the Bush Center for a talk and book signing. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, Gail Samak-Lamon. Her new book is called Ashley's War, the untold story of a team of women soldiers on the special ops battlefield. She'll appear tonight at the Bush Center. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. I found it really poignant that the memorial service for Ashley White was at her high school, but she was only 24 years old.
Yes, it was held in the gym where she used to cheer her brother playing basketball. And at that memorial service, the head of Army Special Operations comes and gives this incredibly moving speech to Ashley and all of her sisters and says, you know, make no mistake about it. These women are warriors, and they have written a new chapter in what it means to be a female in the United States Army. And I think that speech is one that I really wanted to show in Ashley's War, because it does show the evolution of what women in uniform have been asked to do. And this group of women was such an incredible group of friends and of sisters and now real family for life and beyond. But this was really the first time they're acknowledged in a public arena and it's through the context of a real tragedy.
What happened to the program after Ashley was killed?
So it went through CST8. So, and this is funny because these women are bound together forever, right? I mean, if you spend a day in a room with a bunch of women from a number of the CST classes, right, CST2 or 5 or 6 or maybe all of them combined, you know, they are this band of sisters. They step on each other's jokes. They are each other's divorce counselors and baby shower hosts and, you know, life coaches. And they're connected in a way that we've never really seen women be connected before. And after CST8, the program is really winding down alongside the Afghanistan war. So it's not completely shuttered, but it's winding down.
The woman who was assigned to essentially replace Ashley found just evidence of her and her spirit everywhere she went.
Yes, Tristan. You know, I mean, this was back to what an incredible cast of women this was. Tristan is one of those people who is a royal character. You know, there's stories about her hawking her class ring for gas money and, you know, all this stuff. But she was this incredible track athlete who could have gone anywhere. Decides on West Point. And at West Point, really understands the stakes of the war because, you know, there are moments of silence now as she's going through West Point for soldiers who are dying in America's wars. And she sees that recruiting poster and immediately thinks, I got to do this. I've got to push myself to this further limit. And goes to Afghanistan, serves. But then when they call her to Kandahar, I mean, she has a moment where she really is frightened, right? And I wanted to include that because I think so many times we think, well, soldiers aren't afraid, right? They're trained. No, it's not that they're not afraid. It's what they do with that fear, you know? And so she is one of those people who wanted very badly to do this mission. But once she gets into becoming Ashley's replacement, she really does feel for a short while like she's the replacement CST. And in Band of Brothers, you know, you see a lot of times how it feels to be that replacement, right? Not very good. And she walks into her room in Kandahar, her new room, and there are Ashley's shoes sitting there. And I think that's a reminder of the stakes of the wars that we fight and also this incredible friendship and bond that these women will have forever.
By the beginning of next year, the military is to have figured out how to fully integrate by gender pretty much every branch of the armed services and what each unit does. What do you know about the progress of that effort?
You know, in the epilogue of Ashley's War, there's a special operations commander who actually cites Ashley and her teammates and says that they performed tremendously on the field, and that they may well have laid the foundation for ultimate integration, which is another reason why I wanted to tell this story. They really did. They stood on the shoulders of everybody who had come before them, and they did help pave the way, these women in Ashley's War, for everybody who would come afterward. January 1, 2016, all roles are to open to women or an explanation given as to why they will not. And a lot of the conversations we're hearing around women in combat right now are about whether there will be exemption sought and where.
Will women still have a choice in a way that men don't as to where they get assigned?
Well, you know, there is a sense that women want to. I think that actually there's a sense that women will still have a choice. There are some women who would argue that, you know, we shouldn't, right? It should all be assigned. But it looks like women would still have a choice. But these are all very live conversations. And I think that's why it's such a fascinating point in history, is that we're watching change right before our very eyes. You know, one of the Rangers, the Ranger who trains them at pre-mission training, really finishes his week with these women by saying, you know, we've just witnessed history. You know, these may well be our own Tuskegee Airmen one day. And I do think that a lot of people who've been watching these shifts do feel like they're watching history unfold.
You mentioned the Tuskegee Airmen. A few weeks ago on the show, we did a discussion about the first black employees at NASA who really basically just felt like their way of protesting any kind of racism was just showing up every day and doing an excellent job. But the title of that book was They Could Not Fail, or We Could Not Fail, because they felt like if they did, then everybody who came along after them would be judged by the same standard. And that's exactly how these women saw their work.
Absolutely. And in fact, that could have been the title of this story, too. You know, this Ashley's War could certainly have had that title as well, because there's a sense throughout, that any mistake they make is not just one mistake. It's a mistake on the behalf of everybody who will come after them. And in fact, in one of the early moments of Ashley's war, their instructor at Fort Bragg says, this is an opportunity as much to fail as it is to succeed, and know the eyes of the nation will be watching you. They know that the scrutiny is intense, and that any time that they mess up, it will not just be their mess up. It will be all of theirs and all women's. And so I think they work even harder. They stay in the gym even longer. They push themselves to go even farther for that reason.
Yeah, these women were working out like two and three times a day.
Yes. I mean, and what's fascinating is that they were really women who kind of lived in the and. You know, Green Beret read this early and said, you have a typo because the words S-P-N-A-X is in your book. And I said, oh, no, ask your wife. That's Spanx. And that actually is a real thing. And, you know, these women, the uniforms, they were made for men. Mm-hmm. So they were big where they should be small and small where they should be big. And so Lane goes on Amazon and orders Spanx to her base to wear under her uniform. I mean, these were women who would, you know, wear Spanx and then would put on body armor, would go climb ropes, would run for miles, would be able to keep up alongside some of America's fittest fighters out there every single night. And they were this real mix that we haven't seen.
It's a great story, too, as this country and our culture in general kind of forges new paths into defining what gender identity is. And I don't mean that people necessarily had gender identity that was different from the way they were born, but it's no longer such a shock to meet a woman who likes to bake bread and put on sparkly earrings and also can, you know, wield a weapon on a battlefield, in the same way that it's not so shocking to see a man who can rock his baby to sleep and do the same thing.
Yes, and I think that is part of what these women embody so much. I mean, Ashley's War is really shines a spotlight on this group of women who very much were, you know, wives and mothers and daughters, right? And also people who loved to go put a 45-pound, 50-pound rucksack on and go out on a nighttime operation alongside the best of the best in service to a larger goal, which was, you know, the United States of America, which had sent them there. And I think this friendship story was so powerful because for so many of them, it was the first time they had been around women like them, right, who had the both, you know, who lived in that and. And I think, as one of them said to me early on, it was like being a giraffe at the zoo who for the first time realizes there's more than one of them.
Hmm. How have Ashley's family members coped with their grief and sort of turned what they've experienced into something that has meaning for more than just the family?
It is not easy, but they really do embody grace and strength and heart and courage in exactly the same way Ashley did. You understand where she came from when you are around her family. And the thing that struck me the very first time we met is a story that Mrs. White told me about going to a school to give thank yous after people had given her a bunch of, they had made cards for her. So she brought cookies for the children. And a little girl said, what did Ashley do? And Mrs. White said she jumped out of airplanes and she went on missions and she ran for miles and she, you know, fast roped. And this little girl turned to a boy, little boy next to her and said, see, I can do that. And you can't tell me I can't. I can be just like Ashley. And I think that is what you realize. It is not her death that defines her. It's her life. And that is why telling Ashley's War was so very important to me, right, was that this was a story we hadn't heard about a heroism we hadn't seen.
For the people who were so involved in these efforts, even if people leave and are unscathed by, you know, physical trauma, there's still an adjustment process that isn't easy. And I wonder if it's any different for female soldiers than for male soldiers.
It's so much harder because people don't think they've seen real combat. Hmm. And in Ashley's War, there's a moment in the epilogue where they all come back to this landmark inn where they first found one another and they're supposed to disperse. It's only a 1-year rotation. And special operations leaders have thanked them. And then they've sent them home. And they said, but you can't send us home. What else could we ever do that would measure up to the year we've just had, to the purpose, to the sacrifice, to the, you know, real limitlessness of what we've been able to do this past year alongside people who are the best at what they do. You can't just send us back to a cubicle. But for a lot of them, that was the reality, was that they were supposed to go back to their conventional Army job. Their commanders in their regular Army job had no idea what they'd been doing. They only knew they'd been down a person for a year. And they were supposed to go on as if nothing had happened. And I think that is what cemented their friendship even more. And in fact, one of the young women who was on these teams was at a book event, and she said, you know, thank you for writing Ashley's War, because in some ways it gave me my history back. Because no one had known what they'd done. And it's very important to note, no one who's talked to me thought they had done anything worth remembering. They just didn't want their teammate forgotten.
That's really interesting. So they were like, it's not really my story, but you should know.
Absolutely. No one would talk about
themselves. Lane. You should know about that's
absolutely
Amber. That's interesting.
Right. You know, no one would tell you a first person story.
Were they hesitant to talk to you at first?
Oh, for certain. Mm-hmm. For certain. And as you know, that's the job of a storyteller. I showed them every piece of work I'd ever done. And I said, you can find me anytime. You can call me anytime. You can write me anytime. You're trusting me with these stories. And I take that responsibility incredibly seriously. And I will be as transparent with you as I possibly can. But this is, you know, I think we all realized about 6 or 8 months in that this was about much more than any one group of women.
When you're doing research, obviously you have interviews to rely on, but you're also looking at documentation. And I wonder how hard it is to see a colorful story based on the military language that is used in sort of formal reports and accounts of what took place.
Well, that is not unique to Ashley's War. But if you have enough experience looking at military accounts, you know, the military isn't there to use adjectives or to write colorfully. They have a job to do, which is to fight very long wars at this moment. So I think once it's like decoding any other language, but it's true that the people who are behind those stories are just fascinating. And they're people that America should know better, right? Less than 0.5% of this country has fought 100% of its wars the past 14 years. And I wanted Ashley's War to show those people, men and women, in all their dimensions, in all their failures, and in all their glories and their grace, and to really show America this is what we're asking of men and women every night and every day.
Is the Army ahead of the other branches in terms of really incorporating women?
You know, they're all having the different ways. You know, the Air Force would say it's ahead of the Army, but they all have very different roles, right? And the Army's the largest, and it has in some ways the hardest job to do, right? Because it has these infantry soldiers that they have to figure out how to integrate. And once you get the infantry question answered, that will help to answer the special operations question. So I do think General Odierno and others who are leading the Army are really wrestling very publicly, and I think with a great deal of candor, in trying to figure out the best way forward that makes the most sense.
I'm curious about the picture on the cover of the book. Is that Ashley?
That is Ashley. And it just happened that was a photo of them from training, where she happened to be the only person, as your readers will see when they pick up the book, your listeners will see when they pick up the book. She just happened to have turned toward the camera at that moment.
And she's sort of in a beam of sunlight, aiming her weapon among a bunch of other soldiers. Yeah, it's a great picture. Well, it has been a real pleasure talking to you, Gail. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Gail Samak-Lamon is Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Ashley's War, the untold story of a team of women soldiers on the Special Ops battlefield. She's in town to appear tonight at the Bush Center, where there will be a talk on stage and then a book signing. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.